We had a matter dismissed just this morning, so that's why we are ready to go early.
Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Jessica Merz-Gaddis, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Troy Hines. Mr. Hines was convicted of possessing methamphetamine in a pipe found by police during a search of a minivan in which he was one of three passengers. The issue before the court today, broadly stated, is whether the circumstantial evidence was sufficient to prove Mr. Hines guilty under a theory of joint constructive possession. More specifically, the issue is whether the circumstances proved, on the whole, are inconsistent with a reasonable hypothesis that Mr. Hines did not knowingly exercise dominion and control over these items. Now, of course, as this court is well aware, the first step in the analysis is to identify the circumstances proved. And on that point, I'd like to address what is raised in respondent's brief, which is a suggestion that a fatal flaw in appellant's argument is that suggestion that I have not properly identified the circumstances proved. I'd ask the court to compare appellant's brief at pages 13 and 14 with respondent's brief at pages 12 through 14, and I think you'll see that we actually do agree on what the circumstances proved are. I'm at a bit of a loss to know what it is that I have allegedly incorrectly identified. And to the suggestion that appellant is asking this court to view these circumstances in isolation rather than as a whole, that too is simply incorrect. Viewing the circumstances proved, as we agree them to be and as a whole, what we see is they do not preclude the reasonable inference that Mr. Hines did not knowingly possess the methamphetamine and the pipe found inside the van.
What are the inferences that would be, specifically, that would be inconsistent with, in a joint possession theory of prosecution?
Well, I'm going to suggest to this court that this case is really exactly like Harris and controlled by Harris. And it may well be that it is reasonable to infer joint possession between the two backseat passengers in this case. But of course,
you agree that that's one inference.
That's certainly one inference. But what I would say is the circumstances proved that we have in this case are exactly like the circumstances proved that were at issue in Harris. And if the court would indulge me, I'd just like to walk you through a few of those facts to really point out to you how this case is really on all fours facts.
Can you highlight what you are the three reasonable alternative hypotheses first to help frame factual discussion?
Sure. I think one reasonable alternative hypothesis could be that the contraband was in the vehicle before Mr. Hines even entered the vehicle. What we have in this case is evidence that he was last into the vehicle and that he was only in the vehicle for a short period of time.
I don't know if we can take that as a circumstance proved. The only person who said that would be subject to being disbelieved by the jury, and consequently that's not testimony or evidence that's necessarily part of the verdict.
The court could certainly
know, the jury could have thought they all lied about that and he was living in that van.
And if that's true, then all that we have left is that they were all in the van together.
Right. I just want to be clear that at points I think you're arguing that he was the last person picked up and that is a circumstance proved, and I'm not sure that it is.
Actually, I would agree with you that I did not, that I just said that now. I did not necessarily take that approach in my brief. I would note that the state actually did.
The 15th circumstance proved, I think I'm looking at your brief. Oh, maybe I'm not. Never mind.
No, number 15, if I'm reading, is that your client responded when questioned by the police, okay, if that's the case, I hadn't had nothing on me, I had just gotten picked up.
He did say that, as did the driver, and there was also testimony from the driver of the van,
but
which is, I think, what you were referring
that
to.
Right. They could have disbelieved, the jury could have, and apparently did.
They could have.
Right. That's not consistent with guilt. That doesn't support guilt, the fact that he said, I just got in the van.
That doesn't support guilt, correct. And in any event, no matter when he got in the van, what we're left with is no evidence about who got in when or what was in the van when he got in. And that's held against the state. That's not held against Mr. Hines. That leaves open the reasonableness of the inference that those items were already in there at the point that he became the passenger. That's a fact that was at issue in Harris, again, which is why I keep trying to tie this court back to looking at Harris, looking at another case where we've got multiple occupants in a vehicle where contraband is found in this vehicle, and there may be reasonable inferences that maybe someone individually possessed it, maybe there was joint possession, or a reasonable inference that the person who is charged with it did not knowingly possess the contraband at all. Remember that, again, another fact that's on all fours with Harris is that to the suggestion that the officer sees movement in the vehicle before the vehicle is stopped. That was an issue in Harris as well. Importantly, what the Supreme Court noted in Harris was there was no evidence that the defendant was actually reaching or moving toward the area where the contraband was found. And that's the exact same thing that we have here.
Does the record reflect who was moving around in the back?
What the officer in this case testified to was that he thought there was movement in the back seat more than he thought was normal. He also said he could not tell who or what was moving. So, again, to take you back to Harris, another fact that I think is on all fours is that there was some continued driving of the vehicle in Harris before the vehicle came to a stop, and that's what we have at issue here as well. Now, remember, in Harris, Harris was actually the driver of that vehicle, and even though Harris was the driver and the driver continued on after the officer activated the lights and tried to initiate the stop, that didn't prevent the Supreme Court from concluding that that failure to immediately stop still did not preclude the reasonable inference that that driver did not know that there was contraband in the car. So if that continued movement doesn't preclude the inference with respect to the driver, it certainly can't preclude the inference with respect to Mr. Hines, who's a backseat passenger.
It seems like there's a good chance that the driver here didn't know that it was in the car.
That's entirely possible, too, because one thing that we do know about this case, or, well, I should say what the evidence is in this case, is that she did not own the vehicle.
Right. It wasn't her vehicle, and it seems like, I watched the video, it seems like she's very conversational and doesn't look like they're focused on her at all.
I would agree with you in that regard. The last thing I'd like to point you to is that in Harris, there was DNA evidence found on the gun. It was a gun in that case. And Harris could not be excluded as a contributor to that DNA mixture. Even with that kind of forensic
Nor could
the other people in the car. But my point being, even with that kind of evidence directly tying him to the gun, that still did not preclude the reasonable inference that he wasn't knowingly possessing it on that date. In this case, we have no such evidence. We have nothing like a fingerprint or DNA evidence or anything that would directly tie him to having at some point possessed the contraband.
Well, it seems to me the strongest evidence in favor of the state is the fact that he's high on meth at the time of the stop and that the meth is found in a closed container right next to where he's sitting. And they've taken the middle row out. So, I mean, he and Manila are way back, away from the driver and the other passenger in this vehicle, correct?
That's how I understand the evidence, yes. If I may, I would push back a little bit on this idea that Mr. Hines was high. On that, I would just like to emphasize that what the evidence here is that when the officer who has taken him into custody and is taking him down to the jail suggests to him, hey, Troy, I can tell you're high right now, Mr. Hines' response is very equivocal. He uses the words, well, if I'm high or I might be high. Now, having said that, even if you want to conclude that he was in fact high, I still don't think that that precludes a reasonable inference that he became high before he ever joined this group of people. Now, remember, I pointed this out in my brief, and I'll say it to you again. In closing argument in this case, the state conceded that there was no evidence that Mr. Hines became high using the drugs and pipe that are ultimately found in this case.
Well,
now, that would be it.
There is no such evidence.
There is no evidence. And again, the no evidence falls on the state. If you look back at the analysis that comes in Harris, that the analysis that comes in Sam, the courts repeatedly talk about when there's no evidence to support a particular fact or circumstance, that falls on the state. That allows the reasonable inference of innocence to exist. That benefits Mr. Hines. So I would also like to point out to you that the state, I didn't understand in their brief to be making any effort to distinguish Harris at all. Essentially, the state's argument, as I understood it in the brief, is that the only reasonable inference is one of joint possession here. Well, that may be true, and I'm not going to argue against that, because that's not the issue. That may well exist. But this court goes beyond that to say what other reasonable inferences exist, and is there one that's inconsistent with his guilt? So when we've moved on to that part of the analysis, that's where this case gets decided. And to the extent that the circumstances proved here mirror Harris, and to a certain extent are even much stronger for Mr. Hines than they were for the defendant in Harris, that's where this case is decided, to the extent that the circumstances proved allow the reasonable inference that he did not knowingly possess the contraband, either the methamphetamine or the pipe that was found in this multi-occupant vehicle. That really concludes all I wanted to say on the matter. If there are any other questions, I'm happy to entertain them.
Yeah, are there other circumstances you think support the reasonable inferences? And just to be clear, the reasonable inferences are contraband was in the vehicle before, and I'm still not clear as to what the other two reasonable inferences are.
There could be a reasonable inference that one of the other passengers who was with him in the vehicle at the time, either when the traffic stop was initiated, for example, maybe began to try and hide the contraband. If you recall, the van in this case, the rear door is a sliding door only on one side.
I'm confused by that, by the way. I watched the video, and it looks like Johnny does get out the driver's side, but is there actually a vehicle that's made that way that has a sliding door only on the side that would make you stand in traffic to get into the vehicle?
I guess the best I can answer in this case is I saw the same video that you did, and the description of it in the evidence is that door was only on one side. So that's what I'm going on.
Testimony that the other door was broken or inoperable? Or
I believe the testimony was exclusively that there was only the sliding door on one side. Hmm. There's a front door, obviously, on the passenger side, and you can see the front seat passenger get out of that door. But he certainly did get out the sliding door. So that was one of the theories that defense, I believe, raised in trial in this matter, was this idea that if it were to be believed that Mr. Hines was last into the vehicle, if Mr. Manila had been sitting there first, he could have tucked the drugs into that armrest and slid across, and then Mr. Hines got in the vehicle that way. As I said before, perhaps maybe the most reasonable alternative inference is that all of this stuff was in the van who was owned by somebody else, and it preceded this traffic stop altogether. One other thing, now that I think about it, that I'd like to point out is going back to this idea of what are the circumstances proved. I guess I do realize that there's one point where the state and I disagree about two circumstances proved. And that being, as I've cited, Mr. Manila's behavior during the dog sniff. After all the occupants are taken out of the car, when you watch the video, what you see is that Mr. Manila is expressing concern about the doors of the van still being open and the dog being able to sniff inside the van, and Mr. Manila is asking the officers to close the doors so that the dog can't get in the van.
And the driver as well.
And then the driver does. Mr. Manila does it first, and then the driver says the same thing. I present that to this court as that's a circumstance proved, that he said those things. We see it on the video. That was a circumstance proved, which I say bolsters our reasonable inference that perhaps it was Manila alone who knowingly possessed the contraband in the car, because it was only Mr. Manila, not Mr. Hines, who was expressing any concern about the dog being able to sniff in the van where the contraband is ultimately discovered. Also, a second circumstance proved that I note for the court is that Mr. Manila was known to the officer from prior contacts in recent drug activity. Mr. Hines was not. So again, I say that bolsters the reasonableness of the inference that it was Mr. Manila, perhaps individually, who owned the contraband.
But it was the state's theory that it was jointly possessed between the defendant and Manila?
And that's fine. And those factors may also go to joint possession, too. I understand that. And so do with those circumstances proved what you will. Whether you agree with me or not that their circumstances proved, even if you toss them aside, they're still what we're left with. The circumstances proved that mirror Harris and that still allow for the reasonable inference that Mr. Hines did not knowingly possess the contraband that was in the vehicle. So For these reasons, Your Honor, we would ask that this court conclude that the evidence, the circumstantial evidence, was insufficient and that Mr. Hines' convictions be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. Appellant challenges his fifth-degree controlled substance crime and possession of drug paraphernalia convictions, alleging that the circumstantial evidence presented at trial is insufficient to support those convictions. The circumstances proved at trial here demonstrate that appellant constructively possessed the methamphetamine and pipe found in the backseat of the minivan in which he was riding, and that the only rational inference that accounts for all of the circumstances proved in this case is that appellant, along with Manila, the other backseat passenger, knowingly exercised dominion and control over the methamphetamine and pipe found in the backseat of the minivan. Accordingly, the evidence is sufficient to sustain appellant's conviction, and respondent respectfully asks this court to affirm.
I have a question. Would it be reasonable to assume, or is there a reasonable inference, that appellant solely possessed the meth and pipe?
I think that would be a challenging inference under these facts to conclude that he solely possessed both items, given the fact that one of the circumstances proved is that the nervous behavior of both of the backseat occupants was the same, given the fact that the officer did in fact testify, and it's at page 53 in the transcript, that he saw occupants in the back seat, multiple occupants in the back seat, moving. And that's the testimony in the transcript at page 53. That's one of the circumstances proved. To the extent that there's any discrepancies in the testimony, I think that has to be resolved in favor of the verdict here, which is the clear mandate of the circumstantial evidence standard of review.
He saw them moving, but I didn't see anything that he saw them moving in any particular way.
If you look at, it's pages 53 and 54, I believe.
Yes.
He talks about, a shifting, adjusting, let me just get to the actual page.
Could he tell who was moving, though?
He tested, as far as later, whether it was Mr. Hines and Mr. Manila, he couldn't say exactly who was moving, but he did testify that it appeared to be the occupants of the back seat.
But he couldn't tell if either one or both were moving, though.
He said multiple occupants in the back seat were moving.
That there were multiple occupants.
Yeah, he said there were multiple occupants, but did he say that there were multiple occupants moving?
Yes. Page 53, I observed a significant amount of movement from the occupants in what appeared to be the back seat, more than what's normal. And then he went on the following page, in response to questioning by counsel, to describe the movement as shifting around, kind of sitting up, readjusting, like that. And then the other thing that distinguishes this case from Harris regarding movement is the fact that this movement occurred before the officer ever tried to initiate a traffic stop. The movement in Harris is not described in any detail, and it occurred only after the officer attempted to stop the vehicle in Harris.
I have a question. So we've got Hines and Manila in the back seat, and the door to the vehicle is on which side again?
The driver's side, as
the
I
left
understand
side.
It.
Okay, yes. Driver's side. And Hines is sitting in which seat, and Manila is sitting in which seat?
Hines is sitting on the driver's side, the left side.
Left
and Manila
side.
Is sitting on the right side.
Okay, so if Manila is sitting on the right side, and the only way to get in is from the driver's side, Manila would have access to both the compartment that Hines ultimately is sitting in, as well as the compartment next to his seat, correct?
He may have, depending, again, on Yes, he would have, because I think, based on the record we have, the order that these people enter the van is Manila enters the van first.
Right, and so then Hines enters the van from the only door to get into the back seat last, and he sits right behind the driver's seat. So based on that, why isn't there a reasonable inference that those drugs belong, the drugs and paraphernalia, and the paraphernalia was only found next to Manila, the drugs were only found next to Hines. Why isn't it a reasonable inference that those actually only belonged to Manila, because he's the only one who had access to both sides?
Sure, and I think that's because of other circumstances proved here. One of the significant circumstances proved here is this is the how Hines came about to be in the van. Manila and the driver drive from George, Iowa, a 30 to 45 minute drive in the middle of the night. And at Manila's direction, the driver picks Mr. Hines up in an alley in Worthington. And that's a circumstance proved. That is pretty unusual.
Why?
Why? First of all, she's...
I get picked up in alleys all the time. Joking.
I got picked up in alleys all the time when I was younger and working nights at a restaurant. I mean, it didn't seem odd to me at all.
Sure.
I was joking. He was not.
It doesn't seem odd.
I think it is odd given the circumstances here, particularly the fact that the driver said she had no knowledge more than a few seconds before this happened, that this was going to happen. She couldn't remember where. She didn't know where she was taking Hines. So all of those factor into making this suspicious here.
I'm not sure I follow you, because, I mean, if Hines is associated with Manila and the driver doesn't know who she is, how is that suspicious? I'm not tracking.
Well, I think by itself it's suspicious given the timing in Worthington at this hour. There's basically nothing open in Worthington at this time of night. They've passed any place that could remotely have been open. The bars are closed. There's no given ever.
I'm not sure we can read much into that, though.
Okay, and I think it's one of the circumstances proved, but I don't think it's the only thing. So I'll move on. I think it has to be considered as one of the circumstances proved, and that it is unusual and suspicious. We also have the fact that Hines' behavior in the back seat is the same as Manila's. His behavior betrays a consciousness of guilt.
Well, I think you had all the passenger, all the people in the van or in the vehicle, were acting fairly suspicious. It wasn't like he was the only, or Hines was the only one that was acting like that. But what about the relevance of the fact that both Manila and the driver were the ones prior to the dog sniff said, "Hey, can you close that door?" Manila didn't. That seems to indicate that Manila and the driver potentially knew something might be up. And when Hines was searched, nothing was found on Hines.
Okay, there's a lot there. I don't think that the fact that Manila and the driver asked about the door being closed while the dog conducted the sniff is part of the circumstances proved. It's not.
Why not?
Because if you go to, for example, Harris, and you look at what kinds of facts we look at for the circumstances proved, we're talking about facts that implicate the defendant.
We also look at facts that are uncontroverted as well. And that's like for instance the pickup that's uncontroverted. We can look at facts that are not in controversy or don't rely on credibility assessments. And that's one where it's simply a fact. It's one of the circumstances of what had occurred.
I would to a certain extent, based on Harris, disagree that in establishing the subset of facts that constitute the circumstances proved, you can just lump in uncontroverted facts if they don't implicate the defendant. Harris is very clear that you have to winnow down the evidence presented at trial to a subset of facts that support the verdict. and from there determine whether there are rational inferences inconsistent with guilt.
But this court has also looked at facts that are uncontroverted.
Well, if the court's going to do that, then, and the court has said in published binding precedent that it does that, then I suppose those facts can be taken into consideration. I would submit that they're not particularly relevant. I think we have the defendant's own behavior, which demonstrates his consciousness of guilt. And the fact that other people are equally conscious, it isn't particularly relevant.
That would be consistent with the theory of joint possession.
It would be consistent with the theory of joint possession.
So therefore, it would be relevant then.
I suppose yes, it would be relevant, and I can move on to why the inferences that the appellant has proffered are not rational inferences, because even if you include these other facts that are somewhat in dispute about whether they make up part of the circumstances proved, the appellant's proffered inferences are not rational because they don't account for all of the circumstances proved. The first proffered inference that before Hines was picked up and the drugs were put in the armrest and he didn't know they were there, again, that doesn't account for the strange movements of both of the backseat occupants.
Well, I think that what can account for that is the fact that if he indeed was high on meth already and he didn't want to be taken in for having used meth.
But but being high isn't a crime.
I'm not sure meth users slice it quite that thin.
Well, maybe they don't, but we're looking at this from the jury's perspective and based on what the law is and an objective analysis rather than the defendant's subjective analysis. So I think that's important.
But there's also the fact that this not only was he in a car that he wasn't driving, which is different than Harris, but the car was actually owned by a third party. So Hines is twice removed from.
I think that would be much more compelling and give rise to a rational inference if this case was like Harris and the contraband was found in an area that was equally accessible to all of the occupants of the vehicle.
But you've agreed that I think you conceded that Manila must have entered the van before the appellant, so it was found in an area that was accessible to Manila.
It may have been at one time, yes. My point in response to that is that other circumstances proved demonstrate that inference is not rational.
Why not?
Because of the betrayal of the guilty conscience, because of the identical behavior of shifting around at the approach of the marked squad car, I think those are the most significant things. I also think the fact that Hines is high, and I submit that is the fact that he is high, is part of the circumstances proved. Officer Riley testified to his opinion that he was high.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. If he wasn't high, if someone came in here right now and told me I was high or they thought I was, I think I'd say, I don't think I am.
Right. So I think, the fact that he's high by itself would not demonstrate that he can possess those drugs. When you take it in light of all of the circumstances proved
here, I
think
it's a circumstance.
It makes these other inferences irrational.
But it seems like what you're saying is because all the circumstances proved lead to a rational hypothesis that he did possess the meth and the pipe, therefore you cannot show that there are other reasonable hypotheses. It seems like you're arguing because that one, and I think certainly that's a reasonable hypothesis, is that he did possess both and he put them in there. He was shuffling around. But that's just one. We need to look to see whether or not there are others from the circumstances proved.
That's correct.
And it seems like if you look at, for instance, the fact that he was the last one in, Manila was in before, Manila said, hey, close the door. It was a vehicle that was owned by somebody else. It seems like there are enough circumstances proved here that lead to a reasonable hypothesis that he wasn't in he didn't have joint control over the drugs and the meth pipe, and the meth pipe was over in an area that he didn't move when he got into the vehicle. He didn't sit over there. He was sitting behind the driver's.
Sure.
Why isn't that, based on those circumstances, why isn't that a rational hypothesis, alternative hypothesis?
Which one, that he didn't possess the pipe?
Or the meth.
Or the meth. I think the rational inference, and I see my time has expired,
about to expire.
The other inferences that are proffered have to account for all of the circumstances proved. They can't be rendered unreasonable by the other circumstances proved. It's not that I'm saying that these inferences, you can't, to a certain extent, at least speculate about these inferences and ponder them. But what I'm saying is when you look at all of the circumstances proved, they demonstrate that all of appellant's proffered inferences are not rational. They're rendered unreasonable by other circumstances proved. And I believe that's the proper way to analyze that, and I believe that's the way this court and the Supreme Court have done this in the past. And for all of these reasons, I would ask this court to affirm.
I think we have one more question here.
Well, I might turn into two.
Okay.
The amount of methamphetamine found was 0.2 grams, right?
Correct.
If my math is right, that's like a hundredth of an ounce, maybe less than that.
It's less than a hundredth of an ounce.
It's really small.
Yep.
So the amounts, this shifting in the vehicle weren't to like take a sack of groceries and put them somewhere, whatever shifting there was. We were talking about something that could have easily been handed like this without even.
I certainly would acknowledge that. I could give you my hypothesis about what I believe based on these circumstances was going on in the backseat.
That would be a reasonable hypothesis as well.
I certainly believe it would.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, we've hashed through this all pretty well, and so I don't want to belabor points we've already discussed, but I do want to make two quick points. Hopefully they'll be quick. To this idea that what we're doing here is trying to consider whether the circumstances prove render my alternative reasonable or alternative hypothesis unreasonable, the suggestion was made that that my alternative hypothesis doesn't account for what I wrote down was the, quote, strange movement in the back seat. I'm going to take issue with the characterization of it being strange movement in the back seat. The officer never testified in any kind of characterizing terms that he thought it was strange movement or suspicious movement. And again, I'll take you back to Harris, same case in Harris. And the Supreme Court noted specifically that while there was testimony that there was movement in the back seat in Harris, there was no indication that it was suspicious or that the defendant himself was reaching toward the area where the contraband was found. And that's exactly what we have in this case, too. All we have is an officer who's testifying to an amount of movement, not characterized in any kind of way as strange or suspicious, and specifically not identifying the defendant as moving toward the area where the contraband is found. The second point I wanted to raise is even if we are going to accept a circumstance prove that Mr. Hines was high, I just ask you again to remember that in the state's closing argument in this case, the prosecutor conceded that there was no evidence in this case, no circumstances proved that Mr. Hines was high from the meth and the pipe that were found in this vehicle. Those are the only two points I wanted to make, Your Honors. If there's any other questions, I'm happy to entertain them.
I do have a question. Can you respond to the state's argument that we can't just look at some particular facts, even though they may lead to a conclusion that Hines did not possess either the pipe or the meth, that we can't just look at those in isolation. We still have to look at all the other circumstances in total.
I would agree with that. And obviously, we can only ever talk about one thing at a time. But I would agree that the analysis is looking at all of the circumstances proved in total. And when you look at them in total, what we have in this case are the same set of circumstances that were at issue in Harris, to a certain extent that were at issue in Sam as well. And both those cases are discussed and cited in the briefs for you.
So in some ways, we're left with, if there wasn't a fingerprint found on that bag that was tied to the defendant in a joint possession or DNA or something like that, that there really is no way a state's ever going to be able to prove joint possession if things are concealed in a vehicle?
Not necessarily, Your Honors. I would ask you to look at the analysis that comes in Harris and Sam and look at the fact that the courts have talked about when there is no evidence in a particular case that directly is the wrong word. I don't want to use that. But if there's no evidence in a case that somehow more directly or more clearly ties the defendant to the contraband that he's allegedly constructively possessing at the time of the offense, that's when the evidence is going to be insufficient. But as this court is well aware, I mean, there have been plenty of cases that have come before you challenging the sufficiency of circumstantial evidence of constructive possession, and you've affirmed those convictions. I've had them. I've had several of them where you've affirmed, where we've raised this argument, because in those cases, and everything is very fact-specific, there's some kind of circumstance proved that somehow more directly ties the defendant to the item of contraband that renders unreasonable an inference that he didn't knowingly possess at the time of this offense. But here, just on these facts in this specific case, we don't have any circumstance proved that would render that alternative hypothesis unreasonable. And that's why, just on the facts of this case, the evidence is insufficient.
You're talking about cases like Creighton, for example, where someone falls down and then the thing is right there.
It could be that. And the cases have talked about, whether it's something like a fingerprint or DNA evidence or testimony maybe that I saw him holding it earlier or I saw him reach to the area to tuck it in, furtive movements of some kind or something that somehow more directly connects the defendant
Or if it were visible. Or if it were visible.
Right. Yeah. Or visible to, yes.
The handgun exactly. on the seat case, we had one of those, too, where there's a handgun on the seat in plain view.
Right, exactly.
And that the mere proximity is not enough.
That's right. And that's another important point, too, that it's not just about the proximity. It's about the exercising dominion and control up to the time of arrest.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case was well argued by both counsel. We appreciate that. And thank you for being early so we could move forward with the calendar. That is the last case, then, on our calendar for oral argument, and we will recess.